Good evening and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you tonight. We're going to be checking in with a Kickstarter that is in full swing at the time of this recording and when you are listening to it. They are currently working on an elevated take on the tower defense genre with the game Defense Task Force, and we're going to be discussing it as well as some of the finer details of the genre tonight. So, please welcome from ChillX, one of the designers, Takiri Wicks.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me here. Thanks for hosting us. And look forward to it.
Not a problem, Takiri. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, pretty good. It's early morning here in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think for those of you who don't know, I think the time difference is that you are about, I think, like a little less than a day ahead of me, right?
Actually, most of the time we are one full day ahead. So over here, it's now Sunday, 10 a.m.
Yeah, we are recording this on Saturday, and it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon my time. So it's always interesting when we have these international casts. But as I said, as we are talking right now, the Kickstarter for Defense Task Force has just went live a few days ago, and by the time you guys are listening to it, it should be about midway to almost completed. So I guess first of all, definitely I want to wish you guys the best of luck with the Kickstarter, again, as we're recording this at the start of it.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah, the Kickstarter is interesting for us.
Mm-hmm, definitely. We're going to be discussing it and tower defense design for sure in the coming minutes. So, to start off with, since this is your first time on, for the folks listening, could you talk a little bit about your background in the game industry and kind of like what got you into things when it comes to the tower defense genre?
Well, actually, my background in the game industry will be completely new because for the longest time, I've been working as a software architect, and I always... Like, both me and my best friend, we both always wanted to build a game, but we never actually did anything about it. And this is for like well over 10, 15 years. We've talked about it, and that's about it. But then about 2 years ago, we decided, you know what? Let's give it a shot. And we basically started from scratch because we have never built a game before. And so this is our first game. However, having said that, we've worked in software development for I don't know how many 20 years probably.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got started on it.
Interesting. And it's going to be, if we have a chance to do a live cast later on, I definitely want to talk a little bit more about kind of if you were able to apply your background to the game industry, and were there any interesting aspects that kind of caught you guys off guard, but that would definitely take us into a long time for today, so we'll save that hopefully for the future. But with that said, one question I always like to ask our international guests when we have them on, I guess, what is the state of the independent or just the game industry in New Zealand?
The game industry in New Zealand is actually it's actually quite interesting. You would think that it would be much bigger than it is. But, I mean, there's a very small handful of companies that actually produce games in New Zealand. It's hardly anyone. However, having said that, there's a couple of schools that teach Unity and Unreal, so on and so forth. But yeah, there's very few.
Yeah, that's actually surprising. I've spoken to a few developers in India as well as, of course, Barcelona, Spain. And in those areas, it seems to be very thriving.
New Zealand is, I don't know why that's the case, but this probably, well, I mean, I don't mean by just only 10 companies when I said a handful, but it's not as many as you would expect. There's very few.
Interesting. I guess for the other companies in New Zealand, what kind of games are coming out there?
There's a few out there. There's a company in, I believe, Nelson. They have been producing various versions of flight simulators for at least 10 years now. Then there's a couple of other companies that produce like interactive games, storytelling and so forth, RPG style. There aren't many, there's no RTS games that I'm aware of in the strategy genre. Most of it's RPG / FPS / well, there's flight simulator and simulations.
All right. It will be curious to see how things go moving forward, because I know in different parts of the world, the game industry, especially the independent side, is growing at different paces.
True, true. Independent, I don't know why, but independent, the indie game industry does not seem, I mean, it's hardly there in New Zealand. The studios that I'm talking about are, I mean, they're small companies, but they've been around for a while. There's very few.
Yeah. Very interesting about that. Again, just because of the fact that, especially in the last 10 years, with the rise of digital distribution, Unity, Unreal, and the like, that this is definitely one of the best times, or one of the easiest times, I would say, for people new to get into making games.
To be honest, yes, you're right. I mean, I think about 10 years ago, I looked at this, but then back then, we had pretty much XNA and Unity wasn't quite there. There was Garage Games who had the Torque engine. I looked at that. I actually got a license for that. But I mean, I never got going on it because I guess it was a lot. I mean, it was really hard to find third-party assets. So, I mean, you had to be a full-on developer. I mean, development studio. But today, yes, it's much easier to get into the industry.
Now, a few minutes ago, Terry, you were talking about how you and your friend, and let me just make sure I get his name. Is that Zurika?
Yes, yes, yes. Her name is Zurika, and both of us have been around for a while talking about this.
Yeah, and in the email she sent me, again, you guys have been very passionate about, I guess, what made you decide to start working on Defense Task Force now, considering, you, as you said, you both were talking about it for almost a good decade or more?
I actually do not know what triggered it. It's just we'd been postponing it for so long, and every single time, I got a license, even 10 years ago, I got a license for Garage Games, Torque Engine, I started playing around with it, but just something stopped us. But this time we said, I don't actually know what made us going, but we said, all right, we're going to do it, and we're going to actually put 100% into it. And we just committed to it and just went ahead.
And that's always great to hear. I think it was over a year ago at this point, I spoke with developer Zane from India, who wanted to do their studio's Ogre Head Games, and they did the game Asura, and he said something very similar about how they've been making mobile games at the time, and they just really wanted to commit to making the game that they wanted to, and they just did it. And that's sometimes just all you really need sometimes is that one little push to start making the game.
Yeah, pretty much. It was like it was kind of like that Nike slogan, just do it. It was like, just I don't know. We just went for it, and it started happening.
Awesome. So, as I said a few minutes ago, the Kickstarter for Defense Task Force has just started at the time of this recording. How long have the two of you been working on the game?
We started sometime around about, it may be a month short of 2 years ago that we started on this. And, I mean, back then it was just basically drawing board, nothing there. We started the project, and we had to take a few left turns, if you will. I don't know what the right word is, about turns.
Yeah.
And along the way, the idea developed.
And again, for the two of you, you had no game design experience prior to this, right?
Zero.
Yeah, and it's always very challenging, especially, again, getting into the game industry. I mean, for fans of Game Wisdom listening to this, you know we could have 2 to 3 hour talks on the understated philosophies when it comes to good game design. And for new developers, it's always very challenging, I think, to kind of sit down and figure out just what the heck are we going to do with this game?
Well, on that point, one of the things is I've always been heavily into actually playing games, especially in the strategy genre. So I probably have a collection of well over 200 different strategy games that I just play. I would say that I've played a lot. I don't know how many hours of strategy games. So in terms of the game design, that was not as much of a challenge as understanding the technical sides of it. Like, basically, game development is very different from enterprise app development.
Yeah.
So that's where most of the challenges came in.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. One of the things that we've talked about before is that game design, or just video games in general, are basically the intersection of entertainment and programming. And when you're just designing a straight-up software, you know, for either like commercial use or private use like that, you're not thinking in terms of, can someone really enjoy using this program? And that just adds a whole different wrinkle to the procedure or to the proceedings.
True, because see, with usability design put it this way, the maximum we go into that area in enterprise app development is just the usability design, and even that is what is acceptable and what what will work. Most of the times, budget will be cut from the usability design side of it. Mm. But that's not going to be the case in game development, because it's all about the user experience. It is not about anything else.
Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure you're well aware of at this point, what someone sees when or experiences when playing a game is, you know, it may only take them like a minute or two to play that game, but it can take hours and hours of play testing and design to get the game to that level of refinement.
It's very true. Very true. I mean, it's amazing. Like, small things. Mm-hmm. You could spend a good month building something that'll actually provide. Well, it's like a tiny fraction of the actual game itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my goodness, there's so many topics we could just segue into, Takiri, that would probably take us like, you know, 3-4 hours. You know, we could just sit here and talk. It will probably be like Tuesday or Wednesday your time by the time we get done.
True. Now, well, I mean, you did bring up an interesting point, though. Like, coming from an enterprise app development background, and I built multiple different, you know, corporate, ERP apps, logistics, all of the above. Coming from that background, it definitely gave us a different spin on the game development environment as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of it came. It's been interesting.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Now, I guess you may have already answered the security, but just to elaborate here, besides like the strategy genre, what other games do you typically play?
That's the thing about it. I was never really a fan of FPS games. And put it this way. I mean, yes, back when I was in uni, everyone played Doom 2. If you were around at that time. Doom 2, Wolfenstein, those were FPS games, because those were the first major games that came out. But as soon as, I believe it was Age of Empires was my first strategy game that I ever played. As soon as that came out, after that, it was strategy games and pretty much nothing else.
Oh, yes. We could easily turn this into a strategy game chat, too, as well. That's another genre of mine that I love. And again, I grew up with Age of Empires, StarCraft, Command & Conquer, the whole, you know, the holy trifecta of real-time strategy games back in the 90s. Now, I guess, moving on, talking a little bit more about the tower defense genre, and again, we'll talk more about the Kickstarter and design a defense task force later on in the cast, but what attracted both of you to making a tower defense game as opposed to other genres or subgenres when it comes to strategy games?
A couple of things, right? So one of the areas is, like, if we were going to go for a full-on strategy game, we would need more 3D modelers. And we looked at our skill set, and our skill set is more in the development area. Mm-hmm. So from the 3D modeling, we that's one aspect. We looked at what can we actually get. And most of the models we have, we bought from the asset store, from TurboSquid, and so on and so forth. We just didn't have the resources to have a full-time 3D model on stuff. And that's one of the things that told us, all right, go for the tower defense genre. But having said that, that's not the only reason. The primary reason is because we looked at, the RTS, real-time strategy genre, is very well explored. I mean, there are really, all the areas of it. You've got Supreme Commander on one end, all the way to, you know, the Red Alert and so on and so forth. There was Empire Earth. I mean, there has been multi-million dollar productions in that area. But in the tower defense area, there does not seem to be as many titles that want to fully explore the genre.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the reasons we went there. And another thing I did notice is many people will often take a strategy game, an RTS game, and play it as if it was a tower defense game.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can, for example, Supreme Commander, right? You can start the game, you can set the enemy to insane or whatever else, and then pretty much only focus on building defensive turrets, right? And that you're basically taking Supreme Commander or Supreme Commander 2 and turning it into a tower defense style gameplay. So, yeah, so, and I mean, if you go online, there's a title for that. Not they're not called turtlers, but basically, yeah, people who just basically spam towers. So that's the reason why we chose to go and look in depth into tower defense.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to what you just said a few minutes ago, Takeri, regarding looking at what your respective skill sets were in terms of how you wanted to build your first game. And I just wanted to touch on that and clarify that for people listening, that I think was a very smart decision that the two of you did. Because one of the things that we hear from a lot of first-time developers is the ever-popular, I'm just going to build my dream game, it's going to take me 10 to 15 years, I'm going to put everything into it. And it just gets overwhelming. And it's very important to be able to look at what you're able to do, look at what your team can accomplish, and use that as metrics going forward. It reminds me of when I talked to a game designer, Trayvon Taylor, who's working on a strategy meets action game, Bullock Mayan Warfare. And when we've had him on a few times in the past, he talked about how they just planned everything out in terms of what they can do, how long it takes them to do it, and just having that initial planning or foundational phase, I think is a really smart move, especially, again, as your first title when it comes to indie game development.
Well, you're very right on that. What we did was, for the first 3 months, we actually did not have a specific target. Mm-hmm. We just pretty much explored what could we do in game development. And to be honest, like, my ideal game that I would love to build is more like Supreme Commander. It's mm-hmm. more like Ashes of the Singularity.
Yeah.
But taking it further and reviving the concepts of a really old game. I'm not sure if you ever played it. It's called Warzone 2100. It's from 1999. It was the first 3D RTS game that ever came out.
Hmm.
But one thing that they did in there was the entire game is fully modular.
Oh, mm-hmm.
100% modular. So, I mean, that would have been our ideal, but, I mean, there was no way we were going to possibly achieve that, right? So
maybe for Knock on Wood Kickstarter 2.
yeah, well, put it this way. That was going to... There's no way with our resources we could achieve that. So, I mean, we never even looked at that. Instead, we looked and said, all right, so what could we actually achieve? And then based on that, we picked the subset of, yes, this is what we love to do, and this is the closest to that we can achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then go from there in terms of building things out and keeping it within your budget and your development scope.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's very important to clarify these topics for new developers, because it's very easy to get in that mindset that I can do whatever the hell I want, and who cares what the finished product may be. But as you're aware, I'm sure for any developers listening, it takes a lot to get that game from concept to finished product.
It takes a hell of a lot, because you run into all kinds of issues, mm-hmm. from everything from limitations of the game engine you're using, through to bugs in the game engine using, through to workarounds, through to, oh shoot, I thought that asset would work, but guess what is not going to work? I mean, we ran into something like that, and we just, every time we ran into those hurdles, we made a decision and took a different path.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we approached it. Like, so for example, when we first started the game, we were not going to make it sci-fi alien planet. Instead, we were going to go with a city-based environment where basically you were playing in actually fully done city. Now, we tried procedurally generating cities. Now, we did manage to get it halfway there, but then we realized that there is no way that we can procedurally generate cities, have them look decent, and also manage to get this game done in less than 5 years.
Yeah.
So we were like, okay, let's take a different path.
Mm-hmm. And again, for developers listening to this, we've talked many times about having to focus on your title's core gameplay loop. And anything that will distract or downplay it, you really do need to take that hard look and say, is it really worth it to go down that path? Or do we get back to focusing on what is going to be the main selling point of our title?
True, true. Because, see, we looked at that. Even that one example of using procedurally generated cities, yes, it's cool, but it's pretty much the environment. You can recreate that same gameplay using a different environment that we were able to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. We looked at it and say, all right, without sacrificing the core game mechanics, what else can we do that we can achieve? That was pretty much the question that we kept asking ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And again, when we're talking about these games, as you just said, Akira, that originally, like, if you were to keep with having a procedurally generated city as the environment, it could balloon the scale to 5 years. And it's very hard, I think, for a lot of developers, even those who are established, to plan things out when we start getting into 2, 3, 4+ years of development. I guess, as a quick question, when the two of you sat down and originally started to plan out or spec out Defense Task Force, how long, I guess, did you originally think it would take you to build a game or get to this point?
Original estimate was that it would take us 9 to 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's taken us 2 years.
And that is normal for any developers or any new people listening to it. Whatever you think it's going to take, it's always going to take more. I think that's the common truth of game development.
Pretty much. Very true. Mm-hmm. Because there's just so many unknowns. Unless you're building your 35th game.
Yeah.
There's going to be so many unknowns.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And just to clarify for people listening to Kiri, you said that with Defense Task Force, you are building it with the Unity engine, correct?
That is correct. Again, over there, we looked at the options. We could go with Unreal, mm-hmm. or we could go with Unity. Now, I am fully capable of writing in C++ or C#, but then we looked and said, we do need one other person because I have a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And where is the skill set that we can afford that is good and that is available? And it was Unity. So we went with Unity.
Okay. And in terms of the overall, your team, again, from the Kickstarter, it's called, your studio is called Chillex. How many people are in your studio right now?
So there is myself.
Mm-hmm.
There is Zurika. There is Nicholas, who is a developer. So that's what, because I have a full-time job to pretty much fund the project,
mm-hmm.
and which means I pretty much work after work. Mm-hmm. So, and Nicholas is, we found Nicholas through Upwork, and he's based in Argentina. And yes, so that's him. And then finally, we've got Suchit, who helps with all so many different things. It's everything from marketing to administration to doing everything. So it's basically, we are three friends. And Nicholas, who is working on the project.
All right. And it's always very fascinating when we talk to independent developers here about the sizes of their teams. Because for a lot of people think about game development, they think of teams, you know, in the dozens, or when we talk about AAA studios, in the hundreds. But as we said at the start, thanks to better game engines and just the overall globalization that's been going on, you can have a team of 4 or 5 people work on a game today.
That is very true, because as long as you decide what your core skills are, what you can achieve, then get the rest from somewhere else. So for example, we could have, see, if we wanted to have this, if we wanted, we could have gone with a different plan, which would have required investment and, like you said, gazillions of developers, whatever, is if we were going to do all the 3D modeling ourselves, right, and the environment design, we would need an art director, we would need someone who's really good with soft body modeling, someone else with who's really good with rigid surface, then someone to do all the rigging, etc., etc. The list balloons. So we looked at that and said, all right, in order to achieve what we want to do, can we use purchasable models? The answer was yes. So that means we don't need that entire section. So we looked and said, what is the key critical things? The development, now that you cannot just buy a developed game. That doesn't even make sense. So that is where we decided to put all our effort in. And I do not have a really good skill set with, like, say, for example, shaders. So especially coming from a, you know, enterprise app development background, I was ground zero on shaders. So therefore, with Nicholas, he understands shaders. My math is not that good. His math is really good, et cetera, et cetera. So the person we took on board has a fully complementary skill set to mine. Mm-hmm. I am better at back end. He's way better at the front end.
Yeah. And again, this kind of stuff, it sounds very simple, but it's very important to understand your team structure, especially when you're building a game for the first time. Again, I've spoken to developers, and as you just said to Kiri, it's very important to understand your own limitations and find people to supplement your own abilities like that.
Pretty much, because one of the key things is the ability to recognize, I am not good at this. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I am not going to even try. I'm going to get someone else to do it rather than sit there and just go at it.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Now, with that said, again, we could sit here and talk about game development all day long, but I do want to move on and let's talk a little bit about tower defense design, and then we'll spend the final part of our cast discussing Defense Task Force more specifically. So, the tower defense genre, as you said a few minutes ago, Takiri, one of the reasons why you wanted to use as your first game was just in terms of what you want to do versus what you're able to do. And the tower defense genre in of itself is certainly a fascinating one. For people listening to this cast right now, a lot of us probably started playing it when it came to the modding scene. I guess, what was your first tower defense game?
My first tower defense game was, I'm not sure which one was the actual first, because I used to play StarCraft mods as well, as well as Warcraft mods, which were tower defense mods.
Yeah.
I mean, I've played everything from Legion TD, the mod version, all the way through to an interesting one is Natural Selection. That is a first-person commander, RTS, tower defense combination that is just unique to itself. Defense Grid, Sanctum. I'm not sure which is my first one.
Yeah, me neither. I will tell you, I did get started with Warcraft 3. I know that was the first time with the modding scene, I started to play the tower defense games there. And then, as you just said, things kind of took off. Very similar to the MOBA scene, because of course MOBA started with Defense of the Ancients as a Warcraft 3 mod. And then that, of course, went to League of Legends, and then it seems everybody wanted to do that up until last year, when now PUBG is the new, darling there. But
true.
But the tower defense genre certainly has some very interesting challenges to it. It's a genre that there's been so many examples of, especially from the independent side, that I think similar to major genres like platformers and RPGs, there's just so much out there to absorb that I think it becomes very hard to distill down what makes a good tower defense game from a bad one. And before we get to that question, I just want to ask you, Takiri, what, I guess, attracted you to playing tower defense games in the first place, going from the traditional strategy genre?
Tower defense, the traditional strategy genre still does attract me. I still love it. With tower defense, what happens is, it's a constant problem solving and what's the word for it? It's like a curve fitting that the player is doing.
Optimization?
Correct. It's a constant ongoing optimization problem that you're trying to solve. And I guess in my work, as in just, you know, writing software, that is one thing that I do most of the time, is constantly trying to optimize data flows, you know, database access, transaction processing. So there was a lot of similarity with my work, so that could be what got me into it. But I don't know why, but there is a large number of people who really, really love Tower Defense.
Mm-hmm. And again, that optimization is such a very alluring prospect. And it goes also with the RPG genre, with min-maxing character build, you know, how do I properly spec my character? And it becomes essentially, as you just said, Takeri, it's like its own like pseudo puzzle of what is the best way to do this given what my options are.
Correct. And like with, if you look at it, right, the replayability in a tower defense game is actually quite high if it's done properly. Mm-hmm. Because with an RTS game, right, it's about, unless you're playing online, nothing changes. So you play the campaign once and then you play the campaign twice maybe, and after that it's pretty much you play online with other people and that's it. But with tower defense, if it's done properly, the optimization problem never ends. There is always a slightly more optimized solution to that particular game level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not always, but for quite a while.
Yeah. And we've seen that in games like the original Defense Grid, where you can play that on endless mode, and it's just about how the hell do I keep this up with the waves going exponentially more powerful and longer?
Pretty much, pretty much. Now, with Defense Grid 2, they dropped the endless mode, which is like, I don't know why they did that, mm-hmm. but that was one thing that I loved about the first version is, especially with any tower defense game that provides an endless mode, like you said, it's a never-ending optimization problem. Oh, shoot, I only got up to wave 97. Can I get up to wave 110?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I want to ask you in a few minutes is about when we see the tower defense genre start to add in more persistent elements, stuff like Defense Grid 2, Defender's Quest, and the like. But I want to get back to the question that I asked you a few minutes ago, or what I was talking about, and that is, what elements make a tower defense game work, and when doesn't it work? As we just talked about, a major part when it does work is when you get those optimization problems that you have to solve. But in your opinion, when does a tower defense game lose you?
A tower defense game loses me when there is no depth in it. Mm-hmm. So if you've got three unit types, three tower types, okay, you've got 9 possible combinations, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that completely loses the audience. Another thing is the balancing of it. So balancing of tower defense games is an extremely complex problem because it's an asymmetric, non-linear, multivariate simulation.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the balancing is good and there is a decent number of permutations and combinations, because that's what it's all about, right? You're optimizing the various permutations and combinations. That's really where it keeps it engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And giving the player different ways to create those permutations and combinations. So, for example, a lot of tower defense games do not have pathfinding built in. There is one path, and that's the only path.
Yeah.
So you cannot maze the game, or rather, turn the path of the units into an arbitrary maze. Now, adding that gives the player, just adding that one feature, turns the number of permutations and combinations from, I don't know, it's multiplicative, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that increases it heavily. Another thing is the number of different types of towers. There's no point in having a tower that, well, a different tower type that just does the same thing as the other tower type. It's just a different tower type with a different set of, stats on it. What makes sense is having a different tower, various different tower types that have different attack profiles. So now you've got to think, okay, well, if I put this here, this attacks enemies in this way, then there's targeting modes, right? So you can have the same tower in two different places with different targeting modes. Now, these combinations are what allow you to create that depth of, well, permutation combinations and optimize the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and really good points there, Takiri. One of the things that, going back to the first part about having only a very limited number of towers you can place down, or having that one singular path, one of the things that annoys me is when there's only a fixed number of spots that you can place towers. So in that path, you may only be able to allow to play 6 towers total. Well, then that really limits what you can do, and by extension, it limits the replayability of that, I'm sorry, of that level. Because as you said, when you start letting, when the opportunity is there to have multiple options and variances, it keeps things fresh, because you, again, goes back to what we said a few minutes ago with that almost endless optimization challenge.
Pretty much. Exactly what you said. Like, I mean, if there's only 3 places to place a tower, then there's 3 places to place a tower, and then, okay, you've got 3 towers, and like, okay, what do I do? I've got 9 possible combinations, I'm done.
Yeah.
You find the one that works, and that's it. But when you have that ability of, I mean, you do have to restrict certain things. They have to be, I mean, just because of game mechanics. Mm-hmm. Like, if you allow the player to put a tower just about anywhere, then balancing that is going to be really hard. But at the same time, there's a fine balance in that one. So, for example, allowing the player to put spam towers right next to the spawn point.
Mm-hmm.
That would basically ruin the gameplay for the player. But creating some limitations, but leaving it open-ended for the player is the key.
Yep. And getting that balance right is very hard, as I'm sure you're no doubt aware of, and I'm sure for fans of Tower Defense listening to this right now.
Getting the balance is extremely hard. It's a combination of maths, gameplay testing, and automated balancing. So on the one hand, you've got to balance the various different creeps against the towers, but you also have to balance a different level as well. The level, I don't know of any programmatic balancing method that can be, because the level is designed, right? So you have to play test it. Okay, well, maybe that spot, someone should not place something there. Maybe someone should be able to place something here. You have to continuously play test it. Also, there could be loopholes that, the second you have a level design that's got loopholes where someone can just place one thing in one, or a number of towers in a certain spot, and they've just pretty much lost forever. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things ruin the gameplay, so you got to make sure that none of those exist. Mm-hmm. Super towers, that's another problem. Sometimes the abilities you add on towers can create the permutation where a certain combination of towers creates this super combination,
mm-hmm.
which you just build that, and then you can just go for coffee, come back,
yes.
The game's still playing, all right, just add another 2 towers there, go for, come back in 30 minutes, it's still running.
Yeah,
that kind of spoils it as well.
Yeah, I can think from some of the games I've played, some of the more popular combinations that I've done, I'm sure other people have done, is ever popular. We place like a very powerful splash damage tower, and then you have some kind of slow down field or slow down tower in front of it. It catches all the enemies. The heavy tower hits them all, does massive damage, and you're basically done. You know, you may need like a specific like anti-air tower or, you know, a boss tower or something like that, but otherwise, as you just said, Gary, you can just go have a snack. You're basically done building your field.
pretty much. Like, I mean, there is only one in Defense Grid 2, which is amazing that they manage that. Mm-hmm. So, like in Defense Grid 2 specifically, you drop an area of effect tower, which is the concussion tower. Drop 3 of them. 4 of them. In the middle of that, put their slowdown tower, which mm-hmm. I believe it is a, can't remember, temporal tower, whatever it's called. And on the other side, put laser towers with the slowdown effect on them. So this combination of 5 towers is, I mean, put it this way, Defense Grid did a very, very amazing job of balancing. It's still not massively overpowered, but you can go get a coffee and come back and then just basically build a clone of that same thing a little bit in front.
Yeah.
So that's the only loophole. And so if I play Defense Grid 2, I make sure I never use any concussion towels because I'm just cheating myself.
Mm-hmm. And it's very hard, as we said, with all these different towers to balance them properly. And as you said a few minutes ago, balance them especially against the enemies or creeps. And I definitely want to touch on that topic with you, Takeri. Enemy design in a tower defense game is definitely its own unique beast, because you're not just thinking about how one enemy's going to play, you're thinking about how, you know, 50 to 1,000 of them running along a lane is going to impact things. So when it comes to enemy design, what are your thoughts on that?
So with the enemy design, it is basically, put it this way, yeah, the word is, it's an asymmetric balancing problem, because you've got enemies which have nothing with an RTS game, right? It's a symmetric balancing problem. Both sides have the same type of towers, same type of units. Yes, they might be different races or different legions or whatever you want to call them, mm-hmm. but all you have to do is make sure that each one has a counter to the other.
Yes.
And so because it's symmetric, it's a bit easier to balance. I'm not saying it's easy, I'm just saying it's a bit easier. With tower defense, it's completely asymmetric. You've got a set of towers versus these creeps. So the combinations there, for example, if you have, so one of the creeps that we built is a creep that cloaks all nearby creeps. Now, that is a very dangerous combination, because it can be, sometimes it can be extremely overpowered, and sometimes it can be extremely underpowered. So if that cloaking unit is cloaking a bunch of boss units, that is heavily overpowered, right? But if it is cloaking a bunch of boss units that also have a healer unit in there, that's even worse.
Yes.
For the player. It's like game over. On the other hand, if you've got a cloaker and a healer unit that are cloaking and healing a bunch of like really weak units, that's like the player looks at it and why did they even spawn that? So it's about the combinations. And let's say, and in our one, we've got 25 different units that are broken into roughly 7 different classes of units. Now, 7 different classes, that is 7 times 7 different permutations if there's only 2 units. But within any cluster, you can have about 10 different units. So it's a very large number of permutations to double check and, yeah, balance. I'm not sure if that answered the question, though.
I'm trying to think if there's any other part of that. But I guess in terms of the enemies' abilities themselves, you mentioned a few, cloaking, spawning, healing. Are there any that I think stick out to you as either being too powerful, or those that are just like blips? Like, you know, who cares if the enemy can do this?
It's basically the combination that makes it too powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So, like what I said, is a cloaking unit, cloaking a bunch of boss units that have a couple of healer units in there, and accidentally yet another cloaker in there that's being cloaked by the cloaker, that would be really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really bad. So what we have to do is we have to make sure that the wave spawner algorithm, whatever algorithm that's being used, will never generate those kind of permutations. Now, there are two methods of going about this. One, and this plays a lot into the thing, if you're going to support infinite mode, then you cannot hand design the waves.
Yes.
Because you cannot hand design.
You can't hand design 10 million waves.
you just can't. Which means the waves have to be generated procedurally. And the moment you go into procedural generation of the waves, then you have to make sure that the silly combinations will not occur. So that means you have to think through of all the possible silly permutations and then write code to avoid that. And yes, that's one of the challenges we had.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to the boss enemy, I wanted to get your thoughts on the security. One of the things that we see when it comes to the quote unquote boss units in tower defense games is that they're just essentially giant bullet sponges. and that they just slow the proceedings down a lot. I guess in your opinion, how do you balance the boss unit while keep making sure that it's an interesting unit, something that's going to force you to think about it, but without just completely killing the pace of the game?
So, there's a number of different approaches to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Games like Sanctum and Defense Grid and so on and so forth, they took the approach of when the boss units are spawned, it is a wave of boss units that are spawned.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, well, Defense Grid took that approach, and it does not usually try to mix too many other units with the boss units. Sanctum, on the other hand, went the extra mile and on that particular aspect, and they do mix boss units with other units. Now, the issue with the boss units is this. It is a soaker. So it will soak up the damage from all your towers mm-hmm. for an extended period of time, which means the towers do not have the opportunity to take out the other weaker units that are nearby. Now, we had to actually think through this quite a lot. Now, it is not possible with an infinite wave thing with that many combinations and permutations as what we have. By the way, the reason I'm referring to Defense Grid and Sanctum is those are pretty much two of the reference games that have come out.
Mm-hmm.
Really well done. But I don't actually know anyone from them. In ours, what we did was we looked at it and said, all right, for a human to balance this, we're going to need a very large number of people to sit there and playtest, which is not feasible on our budget. So therefore, we went with algorithmically doing it. So what we've done is we have written basically a balancing simulator, if you wish, which basically runs all the units in various different permutations and combinations against all the different towers and measures their effectiveness. Then it takes that effectiveness into account, readjusts the values, and runs the simulation again. Takes the end result, readjusts the value. It's basically an iterative simulation that continuously programmatically balances the game until it comes up with what seems to be a scenario where it's almost perfectly linearly balanced. So that's what we did in order to actually solve the problem. So it was not hand balanced.
Yeah.
But then what we then realized is that a perfectly balanced tower defense game is actually no fun.
Yeah.
Because once it's perfectly balanced, you really have two or three optimal solutions and that's it. So then what we did was we take the mathematically, algorithmically balanced solution and then hand unbalance it, manually unbalance it. So that means play it and say, all right, I'm going to unbalance it here a little bit. I'm going to unbalance it here a little bit. Create those peaks and troughs in the difficulty, but not in such a way that we've completely ruined it. So that has to be done by hand. But unbalancing a perfectly balanced game is a lot easier than trying to do the whole thing by hand. But if we were doing this by hand, we'd be here forever. We'd never get it done.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very similar to when I spoke with Crow Team about developing the Talos Principle and how they create an AI that basically ran through every conceivable solution to the puzzle and show them the data as to, you know, someone can do this, someone can't do that. And as you said, when we start talking about games built on all these permutations, doing it by hand is just not feasible unless, you know, you have a team of like a few thousand people trying out every possible combination at once.
That is true. Having said that, in our case, it was not feasible to get the computer to algorithmically test every permutation and combination because there's more permutations and combinations than there are grains of sand on the planet. So that was not feasible. So instead, I spent a solid 2 months trying out neural nets, deep learning neural nets, combining that with genetic algorithms, then trying the combination of the two, such as, for example, NEAT, which is uses genetic algorithms to evolve deep learning neural nets. I mean, that's about as far as you can go in that. But what we found is without supercompute power here, we just did not have the computing resources to throw enough at it to get it to work. So the good thing about that approach is that it doesn't have to test all the permutations and combinations because of its nature. It's approximating the solution. Now, so we had to can that. And then what we did was we used a combination of mathematics functions and that to then create the approximated simulation. So without getting into too much detail of how we did it, it's a combination of graph theory, mathematical approximation functions, and neural nets and genetic algorithms. So all four combined together that we kind of did it. Mm-hmm. There's still a 4 to 5% degree of margin of error in the calculated results.
Oh boy. And that that is definitely beyond my realm of knowledge base in terms of what I understand design. But again, there's just so much that can go into this. And as we said earlier in the cast, that a lot of the stuff that you just described, Kerry, the general consumer probably doesn't even think more than like a millisecond on when they're trying to play a tower defense game.
True. We spend months into that, but it's, millisecond.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me check our time here. We're a little over 50 minutes into the actual stream or actual recording. So, I guess another part about tower defense, there's a really good question I want to ask you, but before we get there, getting back to tower design for a second, I wanted to clarify or touch on that. One of the things I think always annoys me about certain tower defense games, and you brought up this as well, Takiri, is when there's either so many towers and they're all just built on the same thing. You have like 5 rapid fire towers, 2 or 3 different kinds of slowdown towers, and so on, that just muddle things. But then, as you said, there's also the factor of the one super tower. I'm trying to remember exact examples all the time in my head, but none are coming to mind. When, thanks to upgrades, you can just have the super fast freezing area effect tower that just does it all by itself. Now, when it comes to balancing, and just think about like tower design like that, what kind of approach did you guys take when it comes to joint defense or defense task force?
So, specifically on the towers, what we did was we looked at it and said, all right, we do not want to create the super tower, and the two types, the only way you can create a super tower is with area of effect, right?
Yeah.
So area of effect, like say for example, fire tower, that's still okay because it's a restricted area of effect. Mm-hmm. The problem is things that just damage every unit within its range. Those ones, we made sure we put only one of those in the game, and we turned down its damage capability quite a bit, and instead gave it other abilities that would complement other mm-hmm. towers. So having that tower there, it's a poison tower. What it does is it does a little bit of poison damage, but it has the other ability of it slows down the shield recharge rate of the units within its range. Now, another thing we are doing is we are adding, we haven't done it yet because the balancing is quite complex on that, but it's fully built, is we are adding strengths and weaknesses of units versus towers. So there will be a few units that will be 100% immune to the poison tower, and it will do nothing against them. So if someone has a plan of just spamming a bunch of poison towers and letting them just do their job, that's not going to work either. So what we did was we carefully made sure that if there is a large area of effect tower, there are multiple counters to that within the stream of creeps that are being spawned. Mm-hmm. That's how we went about it. Now, also in terms of the tower design, what we did was we said, all right, we will have 3 types of projectile towers. Obviously, a machine gun tower, because that's a must-have.
Mm-hmm.
A cannon tower and a sniper tower. Now, all 3 are projectile towers, but to make them different, we architected them such that the cannon tower is really only effective against boss units, whereas the machine gun tower is, well, boss units and other heavy units, the machine gun tower is pretty much useless against those units. So you end up using a combination of the two, and then they're complementary. The sniper tower, what we did was we gave it a very slow firing rate, but extreme high damage and a very long range and the ability not to require line of sight. We made it a railgun. Mm-hmm. So basically what that does is it's a very specialized tower. Deploying a bunch of sniper towers is not going to let you win the game, but deploying a bunch of sniper towers in the right place and getting them to target specific units that are really annoying you, mm-hmm. that is going to help. Well, not there's no winning because it's infinite, but will help you last a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the approaches we took. The other thing is we made sure that the attack profile of all the other towers is different from each other. So we've got a beam tower that pretty much does continuous ongoing damage. Now, just having a laser beam tower and a machine gun tower would be, all right, well, one is a beam of light, the other one shoots projectiles, but the attack profile is identical. So instead, what we did was the laser beam tower, it starts with low damage and ramps up over time. So now it is not the same as the machine gun tower. Its attack profile is different. If it can keep the enemy in range long enough, it'll do more damage than the machine gun tower, but if it can't, it'll do less damage, etc., etc. We created a Tesla tower that does chain damage, meaning its damage chains from one enemy to another. And we created another permutation of that, which is a kind of like an ion beam cannon, whose it shoots a beam of like an energy beam, which bounces from target to target. But the method in which they chain, the one is instant, the other one slowly builds up over time. We created differences in there. So the key thing we did was we tried to make every tower unique so that it has its own specific purpose.
Yeah. And then by extension, it creates those very interesting dynamics or combinations with the other towers that then leads to more strategy. As you said earlier, it allows you to kind of muddle the optimization. Because it's not just about knowing I'm going to build 3 Tesla, 2 Sniper, 1 Cannon, and I'm going to beat everything in the level. You have to start thinking a lot more than that.
Pretty much. And also, once we've balanced and then we can enable it, the unit weaknesses versus towers. So, for example, an Ice Golem will probably be will have less damage, will be more immune to light based weapons we have to make it make sense to the player as well, is what mm-hmm. I'm trying to say. So an Ice Golem, the light waves part straight through it, so a laser beam weapon is going to do nothing to it. A Rock Golem, we're thinking of making it 100% immune to projectiles because it's rock. It just mm-hmm. You fire a gun at a cliff, you're probably not going to do much damage. So that kind of immune. So that kind of weaknesses and strengths also muddles the, just like you said, it muddles the optimization problem, so that the player has to think even harder to say, okay, no, what do I do to counter this? My combination here was working until this unit showed up, and now it's not working. What do I do now?
Mm-hmm. And again, it's always very challenging to, as you said, display that to the player. Now, this will probably be some of a mini tangent now, but in terms of Defense Task Force, do the towers have their own, I guess, set behavior, or is the player allowed to tweak them, you know, at their choosing?
The player is allowed to tweak the targeting mechanism of the tower. So what we did was, we tried to think, what are the things that we could allow the player to tweak and not make the game really, boring to play. So one option was the player could select a unit on the game and all the towers within range would only fire at that unit. Now, we decided not to implement that because that means boss units and other hard combinations, well, the player has just pay attention to the game, click on their unit, and it's gone. But on the other hand, what we did was we added a whole range of targeting priorities. So on the tower, you can tell it to target the strongest unit in its range, the first unit, that means the unit that has moved the furthest, the last unit, which means the unit that has moved the least towards the end target, the weakest unit, the fastest unit, the slowest unit, etc., etc., which means that way you can create combinations of towers that attack different things.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's another very interesting part about that. How have you guys settled on keeping the pace going? Because one of the things that can get very time-consuming is basically pausing the game and constantly, you know, tweaking the towers and, oh, new way, let me pause again, tweak things further. Like, how do you, I guess, balance, like, the need to do that versus keeping the pace of the game going?
So, in this game, there is no ability to pause. Mm-hmm. So we intentionally took that out. If you pause the game, you can pause the game by going to the settings menu and then come back, but the game will, it doesn't allow you to tweak towers or place anything, so you cannot pause the game and put something in place. Now, we did that intentionally because otherwise it would kind of make, in our particular scenario, this is probably not applicable to everyone, it would make it a little bit boring because you just pause the game, adjust everything to a perfect combination, and then press play. Mm-hmm. The idea is to keep the mind continuously engaged, saying, oh, shoot, I missed that. So that has to exist. And we allowed the player to make a limited number of mistakes and still not lose the wave. So that's one thing that we did. I'm not sure if that fully answers the question, though.
I think that is good. I guess another quick question regarding actually losing in terms of losing, like, the map. I know some tower defense games do it by, like, a health system. Some do it by if X number of enemies get across. I guess, what is the lose condition for Defense Task Force?
So in Defense Task Force, what we did was we created a target. It's called the Extractor, that is generating the energy. So the whole game, the concept is, it's set on an alien planet where the humans have run out of energy on Earth. There's this alien planet that's just appeared through a wormhole. I'm just cutting the story really short, summarizing it. So then the humans go there. There's all these zero-point energy crystals, abundant energy. And so they said, all right, let's mine these. But when they start mining it, the planet has an auto-defense system, which spawns these creeps. Now, that extractor is what the player is protecting, and the extractor is basically generating energy, beaming it back to Earth, but 1% of that energy goes in the player's piggy bank. Now, that extractor has a limited amount of hit points on it, so it can survive getting hit by a few enemies, but it can't survive by itself. So if the player misses a few creeps, they'll get to the extractor, they'll attack it, but the extractor also attacks back. It's got a defense system in it. What we did was we built it such that the creeps that are spawned, the damage that they can do to the extractor is equal to their own hit points. Mm-hmm. So when a creep attacks the extractor, it does, let's say, 100 damage. The extractor will do 100 damage back to the creep. So when the extractor gets down to zero, that's a lose condition. But because this is kind of built for infinite waves and losing every game is kind of like, you know, it's like a bit depressing because you're eventually going to lose it, we created a win condition as well. So the idea is this: if you manage to extract more energy than the cost of deploying that platform, the platform into the game, then because every mission has a cost, that's a win condition. If you made less energy than the cost of deploying that game level, it's a win condition. So you could play 150 waves and lose, theoretically, because your extractor got destroyed, but it is a win condition. That's just for a psychological.
Do you have multiple win conditions? So I know some tower defense games will give you, like the easy condition, beat the level, normal condition, beat the level and not take X amount of damage. And then, like, the Horror Edition, beat the level, don't take damage, and be under this amount of resource use.
We are looking at adding that as well, but right now we don't have that built in yet.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, before we talk about more regarding Defense Task Force and the Kickstarter, I just have a few more quick questions regarding, or hopefully quick questions regarding tower defense design, and then we'll move on. So, we've talked about what we thought of some, like, the best and worst parts of it, but here's something that I wanted to ask you about, and that is some of the more interesting takes on tower defense design that's come across in the last few years. And the first one, and you mentioned this a few minutes ago or earlier, is Sanctum. And we've seen these cases of the first-person tower defense genre, where it's less of a strategy game in that regard, and you're an actual character on the field, and you're running around building towers and fighting the enemies. And I just wanted to get your thoughts. What do you think about that take on tower defense design?
To be honest, it's an amazing take. Mm-hmm. It combines the target audience of FPS and strategy and tower defense. It is also an extremely hard take to pull off. So, totally hats off to Coffee Stain Studios for managing that. And to be honest, Sanctum 2 is perhaps one of the best balanced, perfectly done tower defense hybrid first-person shooter. There's a few that have come out, but it's one of the best that exist. There's that hybrid. Then there is also, for example, Anomaly. They have done a reverse tower defense. Mm-hmm. It's basically you are the creeps and the towers are the enemy. that's another very interesting take on it. They are Billions. It's not exactly a tower defense game, but it's a hybrid strategy tower defense combination. RTS tower defense, if you wish. These are all what this does is it expands the genre out, and these are very, all I can say is it's really interesting games, and most of the time if done right it works.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the games you mentioned, Takiri, they're some of my favorites as well. I just recently started playing They Are Billions, so I'm still trying to get used to that one. Now, here's another interesting, I guess, subgenre when it comes to tower defense games, and I think this is one that I find a little bit more polarizing. And these are games that are built on persistent unlocks or persistent upgrades of your towers, as in you beat the level, you earn experience that will then let you permanently upgrade that tower, and then you can go back and play that level with those upgraded towers. A few of those that come to mind would be something like Defense Grid 2, Defender's Quest. I always forget the one that I played. It's like a Flash game as well. And I just want to get your thoughts on this. When you have that level of persistence and you're able to upgrade towers beyond just it within a game space, what do you think about those kinds of games?
We added a few elements of that as well. So one of the takes that we took to make it not just standard, not just basic tower defense, is we added a research and skills tree, which you usually find in strategy games. So what the player does is they play the game, they get energy from the game, which goes in their piggy bank. Then they go into the research tree, and they can then research upgrades to the game, to the towers. Now, to the towers as well as a few other just global abilities. And then when they go and play the game, now next time they're playing the game, they have the ability to, well, they have stronger towers. But one thing we did is, although the tower has, we made it a research, and then there's still a cost in the game. So just because you've unlocked level 2 of a tower doesn't mean you get level 2 of a tower in the game. Mm-hmm. You research and unlock it, makes it available for use in the game. You still have a cost in the game to upgrade that. So that's the take that we took on it. Because what I found personally is, if we went the other track of which you mentioned, which is research, like you play a level, then use whatever you get from that to unlock a higher level of the tower and go back and play. Now you got automatically got that higher level of the tower. It's not as enjoyable, is what I've personally felt.
Mm-hmm. And I think you had a really good point there, Kiri, about the keeping that persistence and but not making it essentially permanent. Because I've played games like that where I think one was like a Defense of Zork, or it's like this like a 60s sci-fi style game where all the persistent upgrades occur outside the game. So basically, I put a point down, lo and behold, my tower now does 10% more damage, and I do nothing. Nothing else changes from within the game space. And I think when you do that, it creates a very offside balance of your game. Because what you're saying is you have no choice but to play it on easy, then you have to unlock all the upgrades with the persistence, and then come back with all the towers fully upgrade, and then you stand the chance. And keeping that in mind, with Defense Task Force, in terms of the difficulty of your various stages and maps, how do you account for the upgrade system when it comes to balancing the game?
So what we did was we built the ability to have the persistent upgrades, but only as a unlock the ability to use in-game.
Mm-hmm.
So then what we've done is we've taken the what we did was we took the machine gun. Let's take, for example, the machine gun tower, right? So we took the machine gun tower and we defined two endpoints, a minimum strength and ability of the tower and a maximum strength and ability of the tower. Then what we did was we broke that down into four stages. Level 1 tower, level 2 tower, level 3 tower. And we assigned costs for researching that and unlocking that, if you wish. But for the actual gameplay use, what we did was we used the same algorithmic balancing algorithm to balance every level of the tower as a tower on its own against the creeps. So we have 10 towers, but in effect, so what we did was we took this as an opportunity to increase permutations and combinations for the player. So effectively, there's 10 towers, but each tower has, well, I guess 3 upgrades. We have 3 variations, but each one is perfectly balanced. So that means you could deploy one machine gun tower, or you could deploy one machine gun tower and upgrade it to level. You could deploy 5 machine gun towers, mm-hmm. or you could deploy one machine gun tower and upgrade it to level 2.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, the reason we did it this way is because in order to cater for infinite waves, there are only limited number of. Well, I mean, there's a large number of places you can put towers, but there's still a limit. Mm-hmm. So, in order to allow the player to go really far in the game, we had to create an upgrade my tower's damage system, but have it balanced. And I don't know if that answered the question properly, though.
I think it did. Like, I'll tell you one of the reasons why this can sometimes bug me. When I was playing Defense Grid 2, one of the things that got on my nerves was I would try to play the game and realize that my starter towers just weren't doing a damn thing against the enemy. The game was basically inherently bound so that if you try to play it on hard mode, you must have your towers at X upgrade or you have no chance of winning. It's just mathematically impossible based on what you have available and how much resources you have at that time. And that's one of the things that can be very tough to get right when you add that persistence in by the fact that is this game compensating or is this game balanced by the fact that I should already have stage 2 towers already developed, or am I just not going to have a snowball's chance in hell to beat that stage?
Right. So to cater for that, yes, I understand exactly what you're saying. Because and that creates also like creating the persistent upgrade where you go out, you upgrade your tower, now it's a super tower. Mm-hmm. That creates that also makes it not fun for the first wave. So you play a level with the starter level tower. And then you can, it's balanced for that. Then you go out, you upgrade the tower, come back. Now the first 5 waves are boring. You can go have coffee and come back. And then you get to play wave 5 to wave 15 or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. So that was that we wanted to avoid. Now, so what we did was we only used the persistent research tree only from the point of view of, so when the player goes to play a game level, they will be able to survive X number of waves using. So what we did was we added, to create more permutations, we have a mission, but you also choose what level layout you're playing that mission with. The first level layout has no cost, but the other ones have a cost to deploy. So when you deploy that level layout on that mission, now with the number of spots that you can deploy towers, you might be able to survive up to wave 50, right? But then if you go out, if you take the income you got from playing and winning that, go out in the main menu, research the level 2 of, let's say, the machine gun tower and the cannon tower and some other tower, come back and play that game, it is still the same optimization problem up to wave 50. But now when you get to wave 50, you have the option of, okay, well, I just unlocked that machine gun tower. Let me upgrade my machine gun tower to level 2 now. Or you can take a different permutation of upgrade them early, but now you have less cash for more towers.
Okay.
So basically what we did was we tried to add that into the optimization problem rather than making it a scenario of, okay, you can play easy, you have to play easy, then you get the money, go back, upgrade your tower, come back, now you can play medium, get the money, go back, upgrade, now you can play hard. It's whether you play the game on easy, medium, or hard, it's the same optimization problem that you're facing. The only difference in ours is the easy is actually not as stressful. It keeps your heart rate a little bit lower.
And there's less waves when you're playing on easy. So like, as you said, you get to like wave 50 and then it may start to scale up.
Correct. It's basically what we're doing is for the different difficulty levels. The only reason we added the we were contemplating of not adding different difficulty levels. The reason we added it is because there are some players who have played lots of tower defense who are really good at it. But then there are some players who haven't really played much tower defense but want to try play it. We don't want to make it so hard for that player. So we had to create different difficulty levels just to cater for, you know, different player profiles. But once, for each player profile, there's a perfect difficulty level is what we tried to achieve.
Definitely sounds interesting, and I'm definitely looking forward. Again, as we said, we're recording this in early February. I'm hoping you guys get your funding, because I'm definitely curious to see how things are handled from a once I get my hands on it kind of experience.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I'm looking forward to that too.
Now, let me do a quick time check here. Yeah, we are just about an hour and 20 in terms of our actual recording. And again, we could do this all day long. We started this when it was daytime around here. Now it's starting to get dark. So if we're not careful, it will be like day and night in New Zealand for you.
True.
But I'm trying to think if there's any last parts just regarding tower defense design. Then we'll probably move on to our final topic. I guess for you, Takiri, is there anything relating to the tower defense genre in general that we haven't touched on that you would like to bring up now?
It's just that tower defense is it has a player base. It's a very interesting genre, but I personally think it has not been very well explored by developers because there's just only a handful of decent tower defense games. I'm not talking about like the Android apps because there's hundreds of those, but I'm just talking about like on the PC and or console.
Yeah, as we said, there's just, it's one of those genres that it has such a basic foundation to it that it's so easy to copy it. But then it becomes a lot harder to say what makes this tower defense game different from this one.
True. Because you don't want to do yet another Me Too. Me Toos don't quite work. Yeah. I mean, that's pointless.
Definitely. And that's a topic we could probably save for another day, for sure. Let's see. I guess with that said, now obviously, as we say, Defense Task Force, the Kickstarter is going on right now. So obviously we can't talk about, you know, the entire scope of design the game just at this moment. But for our final part of the cast, I want to talk a little bit more about the details of the Kickstarter and anything specific or unique to the game that we haven't touched on yet. So, I guess with that said, the first question I have for you now, Takeri, is as we've spent like almost like a good 30, 40 minutes just on tower defense design by itself, when it comes to the Defense Task Force, what do you feel is going to separate it, again, from the quote-unquote Me Too games out there?
Well, one of the areas we looked at is, well, we attacked it from a number of different points of view. One of the things we did was we looked and said, all right, first off, we don't want to have very basic graphics. We wanted to make it a game that had really good, what's the word for it? Really good visuals, if you wish. Now that was very important for us. So what we have done is, I'm not sure if it is FPS. I would not necessarily call it FPS quality graphics to the level of like Witcher 3 or something. But what we did was we put a significant effort into making the game visuals really attractive and, you know, really bright, vibrant, really enjoyable. So a fire tower doesn't just look like it's throwing something. It looks like fire. The missiles actually travel and they are homing missiles and they are, put it this way, they've got like pathfinding in them as well. They leave little smoke trails behind them. So we put a hell of a lot of work into the actual visuals. The creeps themselves, they're not like really reduced models. Instead, they're probably actually, they're FPS quality models that are being used in the game. So the visuals is one area that we put a lot of work into. Everything from the water, the environment. One of the things we did was, well, if it's increased replayability, and because it's designed for infinite waves, every time you play the game level, if it looks the same, it's kind of boring, right? Mm-hmm. So we created a procedurally generated background environment, so that would fill in like each time you play the game, it looks slightly different because the islands are in different places, etc., etc. So that's one thing. The visuals is one thing we put a lot of effort into. The other thing is we added, although there's a campaign storyline, we added permutations and combinations into that. So it's not 100% nonlinear, but it's got permutations. You can play that campaign mission with this game level or with that game level. So it's disconnected. You're actually constructing, although you're playing a campaign, you're constructing your mission when you decide to play that campaign. Another thing is we put into it a tech tree research. So you normally get tech research trees in strategy games, not that often in tower defense. So we took the whole concept of the tech research tree from strategy, and we put that into the tower defense genre. And the other thing is like we're putting a lot of work into the wave algorithm, so that it generates interesting waves procedurally so that it can handle an arbitrary number of waves. Also, making sure that each wave is unique. So you play the game now, wave two might look like this, but you go out, you come back, you play the exact same mission again. Wave two is not going to look exactly like the last time you played wave two. It's a different wave two. Similar difficulty, but its composition is different. So we put effort into that. And then, of course, like I said earlier, it's the permutations and combinations of the units versus the towers. We tried to create as many as possible. The dynamic pathfinding. So what we did was we tried to make, instead of saying, okay, let's look at what games are out there and how do we make this different, we looked at it from the angle of, okay, if I was playing a tower defense game, what are the things I would love to see in it that would make it more interesting to me? And we, not just me, we talked to a few other people who play tower defense games, got the feedback, boiled it down, and that's what we tried to do.
Hmm. And again, it's very interesting when you're trying to take things in a different direction for an established genre, because you always run that risk of, do I make it so similar that people just, again, go back to, this is just like someone else's game, or do you make it so different, but then it alienates fans of that genre?
Correct. Very true. So what we did was, there are some features that we were thinking of adding, which we were not sure, and we could not take that risk, this being our first game. So what we did was, we then took the list of, well, these are all the things we would love to have, and we said, all right, what are the things that are commonly accepted by players of the genre? And then we cut the list down to what we think is currently acceptable. So we did not take too much of a risk on that, this being our first game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, made it unique enough, but not so that it's... We did not go with the apocalyptic theme just because we were not sure if that would work or not. Instead, we went with the sci-fi theme because we know that the sci-fi theme works.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Yeah. And having the campaign kind of allow the player to like pick and choose what they want to do, I think that's very interesting. Allow them to kind of control the pace of things. Again, we really don't see that too much in the tower defense genre.
Usually no, because you basically play, all right, here's your 20-mission campaign. Mission 1 will always look like this. So instead of that, what we did was we said, all right, we're going to give the player the ability to choose what's going to be the game layout for this mission by disconnecting that from the mission. So what happens is the player is deploying these rigs to extract energy from the surface from the crystals on this planet, etc., etc. But the player chooses which rig they're going to use for that mission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some rigs are really expensive. Some rigs are, well, the one that is free. So if the player has run out of cash or energy, then they deploy the free rig, get some cash, and then they can try deploying one of the bigger rigs. But if they completely lose, they go back and get some more money using the free rig and then try again. So the player always has a way back in. But at the same time, what we did was, you choose what you think is going to be the most optimal game layout for that mission.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, there's only 10, technically there's only 10 towers in the game, right? But of course, they can be upgraded to the different tiers.
Correct. So the upgrades, I mean, they're not permanent, meaning you research them, but when you research them, you're just unlocking the ability to use them in the mm-hmm. game. We added that permutation because then that gives you a purpose for the income that you get from playing that mission. Now, there are 10 different tower types, but each tower type has 3 different levels. And when you get to the third level, you can then upgrade each attribute individually. So the towers themselves, for example, the rotation speed of the tower. If a tower cannot point at the target enemy, it's not going to shoot. So it has to keep pointing at the target enemy. So if a fast enemy is moving really close to the tower, it cannot turn fast enough to keep that target in sight. So therefore, that is one of the upgrades you have. You can actually take the tower and upgrade the rate at which it turns, upgrade its damage, upgrade its range. So that's after the third level. And balancing that is really hard, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I think, like I said, we are now hitting an hour and a half, and I think we could probably start to wrap things up here. And again, definitely wish you guys the best of luck with the game, and hopefully next time we talk, you'll have some good news to report on things. But to begin to wrap things up for tonight, and I know we didn't spend too much time on the Kickstarter. I think that we could probably save for another cast. For people listening to this right now, when does the Kickstarter for Defense Task Force end?
It ends on the 6th of March.
Mm-hmm. And if you guys do get funded, what kind of timetable are you looking at to actually publish the game?
We're looking at early July. We might be able to release it in June, but we've committed to July.
Okay. And for people watching, what kind of platforms are you shooting to have it on?
For the initial game, given that this is our first and we have limited resources, we are targeting Windows only.
Okay. Will it be on GOG, Humble Bundle, Steam, stuff like that?
It is going to be on Steam. We've chosen to go via Steam because, once again, we don't have the resources to handle build management, distribution, mm-hmm. and et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be on Steam. GOG, Humble Bundle, we're going to look at as a second pass after we've got the Steam launch done.
All right. I guess with that said, again, there's still so much we can talk about for it now, but with things getting a little bit late as it is. Before we say goodnight, in terms of the Kickstarter or just the game design of Defense Task Force, is there anything special that we haven't touched on that you would like to bring up now?
I think we probably covered a lot, except that, well, this is our first Kickstarter, so we are learning as we go. We have never run a Kickstarter before, so we're learning the marketing, learning how to promote it. That's a challenge in itself, but that's, like you said, for another day. I think we've covered pretty much most of the things.
All right. I'm trying to think if there's any last-minute questions I have regarding the design of Defense Task Force. I think I'm just about out of questions. Again, by the fact that the game isn't technically out yet, it does limit what we can talk about, what is or what isn't in the game. I guess here's one. For people listening to this right now, in terms of what you have done, how far along is the game at this point?
The game is actually fully functional mm-hmm. and fully playable. So we have a couple people beta testing it and so forth. What is not done right now is a lot of the polishing mm-hmm. and balancing some of the aspects that we have built but not enabled because it's not yet balanced, like the strengths and weaknesses and so forth. Mm-hmm. The strengths of units versus towers and weaknesses of units versus towers. The game is fully functional and playable. It's just a few other things that need to be done, like, one more thing that needs to be done is the cutscenes and the mission. We need to write the mission storyline. So all of the nice things that make the game really, mm-hmm. Really nice and polished, a few of those need to be done. We'd like to improve the 3D models of the layouts of or the game levels themselves. We need to do a bit more beta testing, of course, and the balancing. Also, audio voiceovers. So as a game, it is fully functional, but it is not complete, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that polish and refinement are always very important, especially in the eyes of someone looking at your game on Steam or any other digital store.
That's very true, and that's why we decided to go with Kickstarter, is because we really need that help from Kickstarter to do that final polishing, and we don't want to release a game without that final polishing.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And it definitely sounds interesting. I like the idea of this algorithmic or procedural generation approach to the waves. And again, thinking about things in terms of having that level of persistence in order to have replayability, but not having it essentially lock the gameplay to say that if I don't have X tower upgrade, I can't beat the stage kind of thing.
Correct. We did not want to do that because then that gets boring as well. And mm-hmm. anything that locks a certain path through the game, we tried to avoid.
Mm-hmm. I guess here's one question I'm sure Tower Defense fans want to know. Are you able to use the walling tactic in a Defense Task Force?
The walling tactic? I'm not
being able to build like mazes or, place your towers.
Yes, mazing. Correct. That is one of the key pieces of functionality that we built right from day one. All the creeps do not actually follow a path. They use real-time pathfinding. And then we created the paths because, it's tower defense. We don't want them just running everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then we created the ability for the player to block the paths and create their own paths.
Mm-hmm. And that's always a good thing for tower defense fans to hear, sure. when you can maze around. And just, as you said earlier, as we've talked about, it adds, again, to the number of permutations that you can have when you're coming up with your strategy. And you need all that in order to keep the player invested in playing.
Very true. Very true.
All right. So, I think with that, let's begin to wrap things up. We were for those of you listening, we were talking about this before the cast. We may try to do a live stream with the rest of the team, or maybe just with Kiri later in March, just in time for the end. So, if we can't get around to that, again, I want to wish you guys the best of luck with Defense Task Force and for the rest of the development of the game.
Yes, I'm really hoping that our Kickstarter campaign goes well, because that is really vital for us. So, I mean, even 1 cent that someone, well, not 1 cent, but even a dollar pitched into the campaign really helps us.
Mm-hmm. And I guess to wrap things up for now, for people listening to this, I want to either follow you guys or look up more about Defense Task Force. Are there any websites or Twitter or social media, anything you would like to talk about right now before we say goodnight?
Well, we've got our Facebook fan page up, and that's got a lot of videos and a lot of content about the game. Mm-hmm. Twitter feed, we are very active on Twitter. So on Facebook, it's Facebook.com/Defense Task Force. Mm-hmm. On Twitter, it is Defense TF. And we've also got a press kit link that we could give to anyone that wants. The game is actually listed on Steam right now, although it's listed as coming soon. Mm-hmm. So, yes, correct.
All right. And on Kickstarter, it's just if they search Defense Task Force, they should be able to find it.
On Kickstarter, it's Defense Task Force, yes.
All right. Well, again, it has been a pleasure talking with you. We were planning to have Zurika on, but I believe she was in a meeting. So unfortunately, we missed talking to her, but we'll see what happens if we can get that second cast scheduled.
That would be amazing. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. So, with all that said, we are going to end things for this week's Perceptive Podcast. So, be sure to check out Defense Task Force on Kickstarter again as of the time of this recording. And be sure to check back for our next week's cast. So, as always, if you like to support Game Wisdom and what I do, we have several options available. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, submission information and links are available on the front page, and you can, of course, email me at josh@game-wisdom.com if you want to talk about things further. You can find me on Twitter at GWBicer for my regular updates, as well as talks on game design. And, of course, check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, where you'll find daily videos spotlighting indie games, game design discussions, and the as-for-mentioned live developer live casts. And last but not least, you can check out our Patreon, patreon.com/GWBicer, to help support things and allow us to grow. And you can also get access to our private Discord channel, early ad-free versions of our live talks, and more. But with all that said, Takiri, again, thank you for hanging out with me this Saturday, I guess, evening for me, probably Sunday afternoon for you right now.
Thank you very much for having us, and it's been amazing.
Awesome. So, with all that said, once again, thank you for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you next time with another chat about game design and the industry.